Talking about Turkey versus Iraq, the ongoing struggle. We're up to Turkey versus Iraq 2, the Turbo Edition. We're also going to be talking about S-Chip, the second round, and Bush's, again, veto threats. We're going to be talking about some legal issues. Mike Mukasey still up in the air. Guantanamo Bay, a hotbed of intrigue. Talking about the race and how Hillary got taken out in some of the debates. And we're going to go on to nukes in the Middle East and the end of the world. Thursday. It is the first day of November in 2007, and we're going to start the show off, start this week's transmission with a couple of things that are absolutely fresh, right off the news, first thing this morning. We've got the ongoing Iraq versus Turkey crisis with the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, being the little hornet's nest up there along the Iraqi and Turkish border, stirring up all this conflict. And now we've got this report from today's New York Times that Iraq is now asking for Iran's help in calming down the Kurdish rebels. Iraqi officials asked for Iran's help on Wednesday in negotiating a diplomatic solution to the standoff with Turkey over Kurdish guerrillas. Now, coming up in a couple days, there's going to be a summit which is going to focus on stability and security in the region. And the PKK is looking like they're going to be the issue with the PKK is going to be dominating that summit. And Iraq doesn't want that because their country's in shambles. I mean, imagine that. But regardless, Iraq is now making moves to try to help Iran. Iran is sympathetic to the Turkish position because they've been using their location to strike into Iran as well because of issues that are going on there. Let's see. Iranians are prepared to meet again with the United States to discuss Iraq's security. This is a good one, though. He's displeased because American military has detained Iranian officials in Iraq. American troops detained five Iranian officials in Erbil in January, and they have yet to be released. This is going along with how we like to just hold on to guys for no particular good reason. We'll be talking about that in a bit with some issues with the UN and Guantanamo Bay. But that's the current update. As of yesterday, Iraq was limiting supplies to the region, to northern Iraq, to see if they can calm down the PKK. Turkey's still armed and ready to fire, but nothing's going on just yet. The PKK has killed 42 people in Turkey in the past month. Most of them are soldiers, again, but this is a group that has no problem laying mines and causing all kinds of havoc, so... if Iran can go in there now, add a third one to the party and get in there and take these guys out, I wouldn't be against that. For the United States, for our part, has stepped up the amount of intelligence it shares with Turkey on the Kurdish rebels. And, you know, you would think that Turkey, who is a military partner of the United States through which most of our military supplies flow, Turkey's a big conduit because of their location and their friendliness with us, that military supplies get into our troops in Iraq, you would think that they would already have access to a lot of our intelligence about a group that acts both inside their country and inside the country that we are in control of. And they don't. I mean, we've been giving them more so they can know more about what we know, but really, not a whole lot. All right, so that's Iraq asking for Iran's help in the coming Kurdish crisis. The next one is pretty interesting. This is a little bit from the Federal Reserve. They cut interest rates yesterday. They cut one key rate, which is the funds rate, the federal funds rate, and that's to help out the credit issues that are going on, the concerns about a crisis, the concerns about a downturn in the economy. They put $41 billion into the financial system. And, you know, I love the Federal Reserve. It's not part of the government. It's a bank in New York that, because of its stature, holds sway. And that's why Alan Greenspan, who was the previous chairman of the Fed, was considered for a long time to be the most powerful man in the world, because his words were what the U.S. economy hinged on, not the government. Nevertheless, the Fed put $41 billion into the U.S. financial system, so I hope that helps. We'll see. You know, generally adding more money to an economy kind of waters down the value of that money. And we've had the dollar hit record lows against the euro and the pound sterling and other monetary currencies, especially currency in China. The dollar is taking a nosedive, but we're putting money out there. We're dumping more money into the system in hopes that everything gets better. Whether or not that becomes the case, we shall see. Since September, the Fed has cut the federal funds rate, which is the key interest rate that a lot of people look to see how they're going to be factoring their calculations. They've cut that over 0.75%. They cut it a quarter point Wednesday, which is yesterday, and in September they cut it by a half a point. So that puts us, was it 5.25, now down to 4.5. And they're hoping that this is going to help. And whether or not that becomes the case, again, remains to be seen. So, but that's some interesting stuff from the Fed. I'll be the first to admit that I'm not as well-versed as I should be on how the Fed works and why those particular rates are so important. I remember back when Greenspan was the chairman of the Fed, he would be able to say a single word about caution or undue optimism, things like that. He would say one or two words, and it would send things tumbling. So that's fresh off the wires today. That's the newest stuff from today. All right, now we're going to dig in to some stuff here on the Machine Church. This is about the S-CHIP bill and how the Democrats are going for a second round. Nancy Pelosi, who's I guess you'd call it her stock in Congress is tumbling a little bit, to use a reference that we just that's directly analogous to what we were just talking about. She's kind of losing some steam because she's talking a big game, but not a whole lot's happening. Bush accused the Democrats last week, the end of last week, for wasting time on passing this legislation to expand children's health coverage because he has sworn that he would veto it again. And unless things change, that's not going to be able to be overturned. A lot of people are saying the Democrats are also acting on principle because they think this should get done and they're just going to keep driving away at it. For my part, we'll probably see a lot of smoke and mirrors about it, a lot of fire about it until a couple of weeks from now when Congress breaks for Christmas, and then we won't see anything about it again until next year when Congress starts in on their shortened work week. But we'll get to that in a little bit. That's a new one they're talking about. You know, Bush is chiding Congress left and right. I mean, he's got to be tickled pink over how ineffectual this Congress is. He said, quote, "Congress has set a record they should not be proud of. October 26 is the latest date in 20 years that Congress has failed to get a single annual appropriations bill to the president's desk." And what he's talking about there is getting money, getting bills that bring money in to keep the government running. And the Congress shouldn't be too worried because you know, we're not coming up on a government shutdown like we had during the Clinton days, but we're getting close, and there's a lot of money that's sitting there needing to go out. I mean, government's gonna keep running, whether or not that money goes out, because everything's still there. But they need to get bills out to make up that fake money that we're selling to China to make sure that our government keeps working. Bush also chided Congress for failing to approve more money for Iraq and Afghanistan because, you know, God knows we got to keep funneling money into the war that's costing us now trillions of dollars. Congress should stop wasting time and get essential work done on behalf of the American people, Bush said as his final little note on that one. And, you know, again, Nancy Pelosi is vowing to keep this going. She wants to send this bill within a week or so. She wants to have another bill through the Congress that's basically the same as the previous bill on S-CHIP and get that through to the president so he can shoot it down once more. You know, they want the Democrats are talking about how they're going to make Republicans pay for voting to sustain the veto. And, you know, I have a listener that works in the healthcare industry, and from her point of view, S-CHIP isn't all that. I've studied a little bit. I'm not quite too sure about the specifics of it. I know the big challenges to it are that it's a little too open-ended. It allows too much for parents and adults to get backdoors into this coverage that's supposed to be just for the children. And it's also supposed to be, God, that was so terrible, for the children. I sound like a congressman already. Just for children below poverty level. And another issue they're talking about is this expansion to S-CHIP is going to include expanding it to lower middle class families. And, you know, those are the families that are rapidly disappearing because the middle class is shrinking and shrinking. But these are the ones that make enough money to not qualify for Medicaid, but they don't make enough to really logistically handle their own private health insurance. And one of Bush's big challenges was the fact that the bill would expand coverage to these families. And his reasoning for that was he believes in the capital system where, you know, health insurance companies get to bleed us dry and never drop a penny on it. So that's the newest issue with S-CHIP. You've got the Democrats yelling and screaming about how they're going to get this bill back out there. You know, it's not going to pass again. You know, they're going to put this bill together. They're going to get it through both houses of Congress. They might get a couple more Republicans to swing over to their side to help out in challenging the inevitable veto, but it's not going to go through. You know, this president is looking for money to fight wars and to continue spying on us illegally and make sure that companies like Blackwater that have been investigated for massive tax evasion don't have to pay anything in. You know, one of the other big challenges to S-CHIP was the fact that they were proposing a luxury tax. They're going to increase the tax on a pack of cigarettes to fund this. And say what you will about luxury taxes. Personally, I could care less because I don't smoke, so it doesn't affect me, and that's just a plain fact. I'm not trying to soapbox or anything about that. You can do what you want, but it doesn't bother me in the least. But on the other hand, the amount of money they're trying to bring in with this luxury tax, this tax on cigarettes, they're saying is available and out there, and if they add it up, then you're going to bring it in. And we're going to have the money to cover the S-chip. You know, in a previous show, I reported about how S-chip was covered, well, the money was covered. But we did some digging on that. Congress did some digging on that. And some people found out that we would have to have a rampant increase in smokers in order to get the money that they think they can. They're expecting they're going to get. We need more smokers to buy packs of cigarettes and get lung cancer to cover this bill so they can need medical coverage later in life. So believe what you will on the truth commercials, but just seems kind of silly to have numerous federally funded campaigns to stamp out smoking because it's so bad for you, and then propose to fund a healthcare initiative with a tax on cigarettes that realistically, in order to work properly, would need us to see an increase in smokers. So S-chip is still up in the air. I mean, overall and realistically, it's not going to go anywhere. The Democrats are kind of acting on principle at this point because they're not going to get that bill through. You know, I'm going to say that right now. There's no way that this bill is going to go through. It's gone on too long. And it's the same concept that the longer you keep a man in jail, the less chance he has of having a fair trial. And we'll talk about that in a little bit when we get over to Gitmo and some calls from the UN to get Gitmo working the way it's supposed to be. But with that in mind, you know, the longer this bill sits there, the more angles people can look at it from, the more you can pick it apart, and you know. You're probably going to, you know, the Democrats might get a few Republicans to come over and get on the bandwagon to challenge a Bush veto, the inevitable Bush veto. But they probably lose a few too, because we're just giving this thing more time to get picked apart and argued against. And this thing's just going to, it's really just going to sit there. It's a matter of principle at this point, and to be totally honest, it looks to me like some political maneuvering to make it give us the impression that Congress is actually doing some work. And whether or not that's the case, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem like it, as much as I hate to agree with Bush, but he's right when he says that Congress isn't doing a whole lot. The most we've done so far is pass a resolution that declares Iran's Republican Guard a terrorist organization, which I'm sure does wonders for diplomatic relations with that country. I mean, we don't have any diplomatic relations with that country, but wouldn't be a bad idea, in my opinion, to maybe start some up, considering the fact that we're about to bomb them. But we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the show. All right, the next thing we're going to jump into before we go to another track. This is some information from a couple days ago. We're talking about the UN. A gentleman named Martin Scheinen, who is the UN's independent investigator on human rights, has called on the United States to prosecute or release suspects detained in Guantanamo Bay. These are the guys that we are holding as, quote, unlawful enemy combatants. And because of the wording of a Commissions Act we passed last year, we can hold them indefinitely without filing charges, without telling them why they're being held, and never actually bring them to trial. Now, he's this guy, Martin Scheinen, UN independent investigator on human rights, is telling the U.S., he's talking about the U.S. government's CIA practice of extraordinary rendition. Terrorism suspects under this practice are taken to foreign countries for interrogation, and that's basically what Guantanamo is. You know, there is you know, he said he was concerned about what he termed enhanced interrogation techniques reportedly used by the CIA. Now, when we talk about enhanced interrogation techniques, I'm sure we all know what we're talking about. We're talking about torturing people. And I'm sure there's been plenty of everyone's been reporting on Mukasey and the waterboarding issue and that kind of thing, and how he's been waffling. So we'll talk about that in a little bit, but that's what we mean when we say enhanced interrogation techniques, and that's excellent syntax for, you know, sicking dogs on people and lighting them on fire. And the military, our U.S. military, defended the current process of sicking dogs on people and lighting them on fire in a foreign land indefinitely without telling them why they're being held. And again, this is use of the proper terminology. Quote, unlawful enemy combatants held at Guantanamo were afforded more due process than any other captured enemy fighters in the history of warfare. Whether or not that's the case, I don't know. To be totally honest, I do not know. I don't know what due process captured soldiers in World War II got. It's a little far back because we haven't had a whole lot of issues going on with that with due process of war criminals. You know, unless you want to talk to McCain, but that's a whole different story. This is from U.S. Navy Commander Jeff Gordon. He's a Defense Department spokesman on Guantanamo Bay. He said, quote, we will enforce the law as spelled out in the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Now, the Military Commissions Act is the greatest blank check and broad, you know, broadly reaching piece of legislation that our Congress put through. Now, according to the Military Commissions Act, the bare bones basic of it is under that act, the president can declare anyone he wants for any reason a, quote, unlawful enemy combatant. And in doing so, he opens the door for that person who has been declared that term to be held indefinitely wherever deemed necessary or deemed appropriate, held indefinitely without charges being levied against them, and they throw you in a hole and leave you there, and that's basically it. So, you know, we're talking about an act that allows the president to do whatever he wants, basically. I mean, this is what we gave him plenty of during the last Congress, but nevertheless, this is a pretty big one. Furthermore, it allows the president to delegate that authority to declare people unlawful enemy combatants to anyone he chooses. He can set up a whole unlawful enemy combatant department in the Department of Defense, and whoever he wants to appoint can just jump in there and start calling people out. Me, you, your grandma, your dog, your neighbor, doesn't matter. We're all fair game for any reason. For any reason they want, they can call us. They can call us an unlawful enemy combatant. Now, you know, in 2001, the president established these commissions, and this was in the wake of 9/11 and the fervor and that kind of thing. It was declared unlawful by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2006 because it was never authorized by the Congress. And this is our previous Republican Congress before we got the do-something Democrats in there. Now, right after that declaration, right after the Supreme Court said this is unlawful, this isn't viable because it wasn't authorized by Congress. Congress turned around and authorized it. They passed the Military Commissions Act of 2006 immediately afterward in 2006 with the exact same wording, or close enough, to make sure that the president kept all that power that he had given himself in 2001. The best part about all this is the Supreme Court didn't challenge it, didn't declare it unlawful or challenge it because it was unlawful or the fact that it gave the president broad-ranging powers that are way beyond the scope of the executive office. They challenged it and declared it unlawful because Congress never authorized it. So Congress authorizes it, and we have the Military Commissions Act of 2006. And that's the reason that we're keeping everyone we want down at Guantanamo Bay. Now, Shinin has said that wherever possible, ordinary civilian courts should be used to try the terrorist suspects instead of military courts. Now, there's no way that's going to happen because civilian courts have lots of precedents and backdoors and lots of ways to get around things and figure things out and lots of ways to increase the fairness of a trial. A military tribunal is, you know, a bunch of guys in uniforms with chests full of medals staring sternly at you while you try to defend yourself. before they send you to the brig. But, you know, we're using this term, unlawful enemy combatants, you know, which is has been declared numerous times a term of convenience without legal effect. And, you know, Shinan called it that, and he's right. It's just a way to, just an easy way to categorize people that you want to hold on to. You know, he's talking about how the U.S. should release the prisoners at Guantanamo, let them go, or try them, but pick one. Like, make something happen, because these guys are just sitting there, you know. Some of them probably are there for a good reason. Some of them maybe not so good of a reason, you know. There's no you can't interview them in private. You can't go down there and get a word with them without someone watching them, which doesn't bode well for the truthfulness of any responses they might give regarding their treatment or why they're there, how long they've been there, all that kind of stuff. You know, at the end of this article, Shinan mentions that he's been advised that up to 80 detainees will be tried by the military commissions. And the U.S. wants to return the rest to their countries of origin or a third country. So, same, we're getting to the same issue. But that doesn't mean anything. The U.S. wants to return them. Maybe. But will they? Who knows? And, you know, these 80 detainees that will be tried by military commissions, there's no time frame on that. They could say whatever they want. They could say all of them will get tried and sent home. Well, when? I don't know. Whatever. That doesn't make any sense. Right. So, you know, this is just a little bit of scary, because right now the Military Commissions Act is basically being directed at terror suspects. And those, again, and these are international suspects. But it wouldn't take much for Bush or a commission of his choosing starter to aim that gun right here in the U.S., you know, that's one of the 10 steps to a fascist America. And it's targeting key individuals, where you take out important thinkers and agitators, people that are in support of freedom, in support of human rights. You know, this is the kind of thing that this is the kind of steps that our government is taking toward making America less free. It's happening right underneath our noses. It's eroding beneath our feet. But, you know, every once in a while you hear about Gitmo and you go, oh, man, Gitmo sucks. They should close that down. But, you know, do most of us really know what's going on there? No. And we couldn't. There's no way to know because no one's talking about it. You know, it's as closed off as it can possibly be. And when you're talking about a thing like the Military Commissions Act that gives this kind of broad power, it's just a really frightening affair that Our president was so quick to give the power to himself, and then the Congress was so quick to just make sure it was legal because the Supreme Court challenging it. And, you know, the fact that the Supreme Court challenged it on technical grounds, that it wasn't approved, is just kind of scary as well, that something so obvious and dangerous just got straight through. All right. Moving on with the legalese here, we got a little bit about Mukasey. Most people have been talking about him. I'm sure you've heard plenty about how he's waffling on torture and how his confirmation is up for grabs. It's not for sure anymore. And you know, the basics of this, as they said, they wanted to know in a letter. They said, you know, candidate Mukasey, he's waterboarding torture. Would you consider this unlawful? And his response was oranges and peaches. And that's basically the bulk of it, because what he said didn't make a whole lot of sense from a concise statement standpoint. You know, he said that, quote, it would be irresponsible to seek confirmation by providing an uninformed legal opinion based on hypothetical facts and circumstances. Now, if you ask me, The question is, waterboarding torture doesn't have any hypothetical facts or circumstances. It has one question, which is waterboarding torture? And that seems like something that it would be easy to make a legal opinion on. Obviously, it's not, because this guy is, A, trying to get the job, but, B, it's kind of hard to go into that job while after kneecapping the president's ability to use techniques that he's been using to interrogate these terrorist suspects to help help America. And you know, everyone across the spectrum has been saying how they're disappointed with his response. They're saying that it's not appropriate. It's not concise. He's not being forthcoming. That kind of thing. You know, Patrick Leahy, who is the Judiciary Committee chairman, he's a Democrat, and he said that the letter did not satisfy his concerns. Quote, based on an initial review of his response to the letter, I remain very concerned that Judge Mukasey finds himself unable to state unequivocally that waterboarding is illegal and below the standards and values of the United States. And he is. But will that keep him from getting confirmed? Unfortunately, I'm going to go ahead and say probably not, because the last few times we've had confirmation hearings, there's a bit of a trend, and that's that someone pops up and everyone says, oh, this guy's good, we'll take him. And then everyone rattles their saber a little bit. Hey, he's not quite so good. He has this problem and that problem. And then after that, the saber rattling goes away after the press kind of dies down a little bit and he gets confirmed overwhelmingly, and we're stuck with that guy. So I'm going to go ahead and say that we're probably going to see the same thing with Mukasey, despite how disappointed everyone is with his responses. You know, no one's going to go up there. No Republican who sat on the bench and signed material witness warrants to round up suspects in the aftermath of 9/11 and the freewheeling aftermath of 9/11, where anything goes, for bringing in whoever you wanted. Especially when you're talking about things like Military Commissions Act that the president gave himself in 2001. You know, he's never going to say strictly and directly into the microphone, waterboarding is torture and I think it's bad and it's illegal and that I wouldn't stand for it. He's never going to say that, because the guy who nominated him, who is hopefully soon to be his boss as far as he's concerned, is the one who uses these techniques. And he can't go up there and say that, the guy that sponsored me for this job is illegal and he's breaking the law every day and I'm going to fight him on it. It's not how you get a job. You get a job by kissing the boss's ass, and that isn't the case. You know, he says if he found an interrogation practice to violate the law, he would immediately advise President Bush of his finding. Great. Well, what will that do? Nothing. So, you know, Mukasey's little story has turned a little bit south, but not enough to keep him from becoming Attorney General. Because I'll tell you what, who else have you heard about for Attorney General? They're not offering up any alternatives. You know, all this rancor about him not agreeing on waterboarding, you know, is pretty hollow when you consider the fact that he's the only guy. He's the only one we've got for the most part. You know, they're not offering us an alternative candidate. You know, there won't be until he gets voted down, and he's not going to get voted down because Congress is going to Christmas in a couple weeks, and then when they get back, they're not even going to be working as long as they have been. So they're just going to get this done with, so they don't have to worry about it over the holiday, and everyone can get a new iPod and a new car and go home and come back in January to a 4-day work week and relax. So Mike Mukasey's still pretty much a foregone conclusion in my opinion, but you know, at least now there's a little bit of a challenge. People know a little bit more about him. And, you know, that's all we can hope for at this point. All we can hope for is that we know a little bit more about him and we can at least expect what we're going to, you know, have a better expectation of what we're going to see from him when he gets in there. The last little bit is, before we go to a break, is from the American Bar Association. Monday of this week, it called for a moratorium nationwide on the death penalty. There's a challenge in Kentucky with this is a Supreme Court now. There's a Kentucky case that in January, they're going to hear arguments this January coming up from a case in Kentucky that is concerning whether or not the lethal injection method method of execution constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, and whether or not it inflicts unnecessary pain and suffering. And just to give you an example about how fast our Supreme Court works, they're going to hear the arguments in January, and they're forecasting a decision likely before the end of June. Now, that's not for sure. That's probably they're going to have a decision before the end of June. And I know they have to talk. I know the Supreme Court has a lot of cases they have to hear. But this strikes me as kind of a big deal. We're talking about killing people. And whatever you feel about the death penalty, you know, I know a few listeners I have out there are very, very, very much in favor of it. You know, their viewpoint is these people that are on death row are there for a very, very good reason for the most part. And they're sitting in a comfortable solitary cell and getting fed and housed and clothed and all that on our money. So they killed somebody, and they're going to sit on death row for years and years on the taxpayer's dime. And that's definitely one viewpoint that I know a lot of people have. And, you know, they'd prefer to see the death penalty get sped up. You know, the process alleviated, you know, less time for appeals, less chances for an appeal, and basically you go straight into a needle in your arm. Now, that's one view. The other view is that it's barbaric, and a civilized nation like the United States of America shouldn't be practicing such a violent and barbaric method of punishment for its criminals. That's a social commentary that we don't have time to get into today. But regardless, just some quick numbers. So far this year, 42 people have been executed in the United States. And last year, overall, there were 53. So this was as of Monday of this week. So that was 3 days ago. So basically, they've got 2 months to kill, 12 people? 11 people? 12 people to beat the record. There are 38 states in which the death penalty and the federal government as well use the death penalty is considered as an option for punishment. All of those states except for one use lethal injection, and that's what's coming up in question in the Supreme Court in January, is whether lethal injection constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. And the only state that is an exception is the state of Nebraska, which still uses the chair. And if there's any argument in favor of the death penalty being a barbaric and outmoded form of punishment for a legal system, it's the fact that Nebraska still uses the chair. The chair fries your brain, and if they don't wet the sponge, your whole head lights on fire. I mean, it's your eyes pop out and gouts of fire, and it's just not fun. And that's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, if you saw that on TV, we've all seen, I'm sure we've all seen some kind of movie or something where somebody got the chair, you know, so the Green Mile or something like that. That's pretty close. And, you know, when other nations look at that, you know, I'm sure there's a sad shaking of the head that we take our social reprobates, our socially inept, those of us we take our criminals that violate the social contract and burn them to death with electricity. So like I said, whatever you feel about whatever your thoughts on the death penalty, yeah, the American Bar Association is calling for a moratorium on it until the Supreme Court can spend 6 months deciding whether or not lethal injection constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. All right, that's it for the legalese. You are listening to The Machine Church on killradio.org. We're going to go out for a break so I can catch my breath. When we get back, we're going to do a little bit of talking about the candidates and the race for president that's coming up, getting pretty hot and heavy. And after that, we'll talk about the nuclear Middle East and the end of the world, to make sure we talk about the end of the world at least once on the program. And we're gonna go through those things. Talk about how Hillary got Hadouken from the other Democrats in that recent debate.
And under the boughs unbowed, a all clothed in a snowy shroud. She had no heart so hardened, all under the boughs unbowed.
Back, you are listening to the Machine Church on killradio.org. For those of you out there who don't know, Kill Radio is a collective. It is all supported by the DJs, the members, the people that come in here and do shows for your listening pleasure. So if you get a chance, when you're looking around on Kill Radio, check out some of the other shows. And if you get a chance and you like what you hear on some of these programs, it wouldn't be a bad idea to click that little PayPal button on the Kill Radio homepage and donate a little money to us. Because, again, this collective is supported only by the DJs, the listeners, everyone out there who enjoys the programming that we put out. So if you like what you hear, you should support us so that we can keep spewing out that stuff that you apparently like to hear. All right, we're going to go back in. We're going to talk now about the campaign, and it's finally started to heat up a little bit. The numbers aren't quite so runaway as of the 29th of this month, which was or the 29th of last month, which was about 3 days ago. This is the numbers for the presidential race for both Democrats and Republicans in Iowa. And this is Iowa's the big deal coming up in a couple months. And that's going to be one of the first indicators of who we're going to be looking at when it comes down to presidential 08. Now, for the numbers, you've got on the Democratic side, you've got Hillary on top with 29%. Now, that's significantly less than a lot of other numbers from the past couple weeks have been saying. You know, they had her in the 40s, and not quite so much, apparently, at least not in Iowa. Maybe overall she's got bigger numbers, but Iowa's an important place, and in that place she's at 29%. She is followed extremely closely by Barack Obama at 27%, and this is all before, this is prior to the debate of the past nights, where Hillary was pretty roundly beaten about the head and shoulders. John Edwards came in 20%, Bill Richardson had 7%, and Joe Biden was kind of at the kids' table with 5%. Now we switch over to the Republican side, and interestingly enough, well, possibly not interestingly if you know, if you have any concept of how much money he's dumping into his campaign at his own expense, but you got Mitt Romney, the Mormon, with 36%, which still strikes me as odd because, you know, say what you will about faith, but just doesn't seem very very viable for a Mormon candidate to have that much of a say. And that's not me soapboxing again. You know, good friend, a couple of good friends of mine are Mormon. I actually work with a guy who is a Mormon, but with the flap that Kerry got for being a Catholic and the difficulties that Kennedy had when he was up there for being a Catholic, you know, any like clear denomination seems to be kind of a hamstring for a presidential candidate. And Romney is very much a Mormon, and that you know, I'm just concerned that it would be a big hamstring for him. But that doesn't appear to be the case. If you look at the numbers for Republicans in Iowa, Mitt Romney 36%. He is followed in second place with a tie between Giuliani and Mike Huckabee, both hovering at 13%. And then you've got Fred Thompson at 11%. Apparently, they don't show enough Law and Order reruns in Iowa. And John McCain kind of nipping at the back from the kids' table with 6%. So that's where it stands right now, at least the most recent poll as of about 3 days ago. So, and I'm sure everyone's seen either the debate or the fallout from the debate, where Hillary was pretty thoroughly trashed by everyone in attendance. John Edwards was pretty virulent in attacking her, pretty much calling her a waffler, saying she was saying two different things within the space of 2 minutes. You know, you had Obama up there who was a little, I guess, less aggressive, but still the message was the same, you know, talking about how he didn't really understand what she was trying to say. And she was up there looking pretty pretty defeated and pretty robotic, so I'm not sure where how that's going to affect the numbers. But they've still got 2 months, and there's plenty of time for Hillary to pick back up. She's an experienced politician, so I wouldn't say that this is any major blow to her campaign, because she's got plenty of money and she's got plenty of experience and a good staff. But it's interesting to see her falter like that. A lot of the consensus amongst a lot of people, which I tend to agree with, is the fact that in the past Hillary's been able to just kind of use those scripted responses, those rhetoric type responses, and kind of keep above the battle while the rest of the debate participants kind of batter at each other. In this case, that didn't happen. That tactic didn't work for her, because everyone was pretty concentrated in attacking her directly from the front, just stabbing her right there in the face. So again, this probably won't be too much of a hamstring for the Hillary campaign. It's an eyebrow raiser, and it shows some weakness, but it's definitely not gonna hold her back from doing going all guns blazing to make sure she gets into that White House again. So it occurred to me that I use a lot of Street Fighter 2 references that probably don't make a lot of sense to people who listen and have no background in Street Fighter 2. So just real quick as an aside, when I say stuff like Turkey versus Iraq 2, the Turbo Edition, I mean, everyone's played Turbo Street Fighter, at least that I know of. So, I mean, that's pretty obvious. And, you know, you just imagine Turkey and Iraq with a different uniform colors depending on which button you push, and all their moves are super sped up. And the other thing that I always say that I know comes out kind of off the cuff sometimes is Hadouken. And anyone that plays Street Fighter knows that that's Ryu and or Ken's fireball they throw out. So when I say Hillary got Hadouken, I just mean she got blasted by a fireball from a Japanese martial artist. Anyway, sorry, Street Fighter 2 fetish. But moving on, we've got some interesting stuff here from the candidates. And this is them talking about their plans for Iran. And this is kind of an interesting subject because Iran is a good it's a good gauge to see how the candidates are thinking about things. And you've got Republicans, you've got Giuliani, Thompson, and Mitt Romney, and they're all taking a hard line, talking about they're openly in support of possible strikes against Iran. They support, you know, in one breath, you know, they say they support diplomatic measures. In the second breath, they talk openly about being ready and willing to support a strike on Iran. So, not a whole lot of sense there. But nevertheless, you've got to cover both bases. The Democrats on the other side, the message has been pretty much the same. It's been contiguous amongst them that they want diplomacy. How they're going to go about that diplomacy has been up for grabs. In Obama's case, he's saying he wants face-to-face meetings with the leaders of like North Korea and Iran. He wants to meet with Ahmadinejad. He wants to meet with Kim Jong-il directly and have direct diplomacy. Clinton is kind of using that as an attack on him. She's criticizing him for being immature and inexperienced, saying that he's his lack of experience is what's making him say these things, which aren't as effective. But on the same breath, she talks about how she wants to have vigorous diplomacy. You know, she's calling him, on the one hand, she's calling Obama irresponsible and naive on foreign policy. On the other hand, she's saying she wants direct diplomacy with Iran and countries such as North Korea. She won't commit to leader to leader meetings with these countries that really hold a lot of kind of bullish power, given their international standing. She won't meet with them directly. She won't talk to these guys face to face. And then in the other breath, she says she's in favor of direct diplomacy. Now, I don't know. Obviously, I'm not an experienced politician on the same level as Hillary Clinton. But when you say you want direct diplomacy, seems to me the logic would dictate the most direct form of diplomacy would be you sitting down with the person you want to have diplomatic relations with and talking with them, not sending intermediaries, secretaries of state like Condi Rice to go and talk and not really achieve anything. And, you know, just having said that, that's probably the most likely thing that is desired, to not have anything achieved. And the easiest way to not get anything done is to send people with send secondaries and intermediaries with vague agendas and no real authority to get anything done to talk amongst themselves. So it's nice. I mean, it's quaint and it's cute, and all of our diplomats get to have a job and wear a suit, go to nice hotels in fancy far off countries and talk about how bad everything's going and not get anything done, and then report back to their leaders that nothing's going to get done, and we sit around, there's some tension, and it comes back and we do it again. So that's the Democrat point of view, that we should have this diplomacy, and whether you like Obama's take, which is do it directly and have meetings directly, or you like Hillary's take, which is to, you know, send intermediaries and send diplomats. That's what they're paid for. That's what they're trained in. That kind of thing. You know, we haven't had a president who was an effective at foreign policy since Nixon. And you know, despite the unceremonious end to his presidency, he did do a lot in the international scene. He reopened relations with China, which may or may not have been a good thing, considering where we're at with China these days. But nevertheless, he did some pretty amazing stuff on the international scene, despite his being too obvious with his political shenanigans. You know, it's a comfortable policy issue for the Republicans to talk hard about Iran, because you know, they're Republicans. They're supposed to be the conservatives. They're supposed to be the hardliners. And they're supposed to be the ones standing up in there and say, we're going to bomb those bastards. we're going to bomb them back into the Stone Age to make sure they don't get a nuke to threaten America with terror. And that's what you want to hear from a Republican candidate. If you're a Republican voter, you want to hear your candidate go up there and talk about how he's going to bomb those bastards back into the Stone Age. You know, and if you're a Democrat, then you want to hear your candidate go up there and talk about how they are in favor of diplomacy, of whatever whatever method they prefer. But they want diplomatic solutions before there's a military use of force. And so this is, despite how difficult and thorny this issue is, it's really being treated as partisan as possible. Democrats say diplomacy, Republicans say bomb the fuck out of them. And that's where we're at. Surprisingly enough, John McCain has been the least rancorous in his rhetoric against Iran. He has not been talking openly about strikes and talking about how he would support military action against Iran. And this guy, you know, with his military background, probably has more insight in it than the guys like Giuliani, you know, or Fred Thompson. You know, I'm sure if Iran wanted to set up an acting situation where everyone would go and play a role and pretend to be who they were to resolve issues, then Fred Thompson would be a good choice. But McCain has said one thing about it. This is his quote. There's only one thing worse than military action against Iran, and that's a nuclear armed Iran. So you can take that as you like it. A nuclear armed Iran is bad. But taking military action against Iran and getting us embroiled in further war in the Middle East is right up there on the list. That's about second in line for how bad it could be. You've got this rhetoric. You know, Giuliani says Giuliani has promised a strike if Iran develops a weapon during his presidency, and whether or not that happens. You know, it's easy to say that now, especially when you've got varying reports on Iran's ability to actually get to the place where they can build a weapon from anywhere from 3 to 8 years all the way up to decades. So it's easy to stand there on the campaign trail. I'm going to bomb the hell out of those guys if they get a nuke. And, you know, when you can sit back reliably and know that it's not probably going to happen, you're not going to have to worry about lying about, you know, or having to follow up on that campaign promise. And then you have Mitt Romney, who, sometimes I just wonder where this stuff comes from. Because you've got Mitt Romney, and last month he proposed indicting Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, on a charge of inciting genocide. And, you know, if you followed Ahmadinejad with any frequency like I do, you know, you'd know his views. He's not a big fan of the Israeli state. He's not a big fan of contemporary history, and you can take that as it is. That's a thorny subject that I don't feel like delving into right now. But to just wantonly call out for these kinds of things, it doesn't. Regardless of the man's policies, he is the leader, or close to the leader, because the president of Iran doesn't lead Iran. The supreme leader, which is an actual title, the supreme leader of Iran, who is the head of the Muslim clerical council that actually rules the country, is the leader, but Ahmadinejad is the figurehead, and he's the one in the public eye. Regardless of his views, you know, his nation is an important nation in the region, and it would bode well for the U.S. to try to have some diplomacy with that nation instead of the previous policy of just throwing the weight around and blowing the hell out of things. You know, McCain said, the only thing worse than a nuclear than military action against Iran is a nuclear-armed Iran. So take what you will from Iran saying that they have a peaceful nuclear program. Whether or not that's the case remains to be seen, but throwing around, you know, on the campaign trail, throwing around these kind of you puff out your chest and pull up your pants and, whoa, you know, we should indict this guy. Inciting genocide. And it's fancy to throw that around on the campaign trail, but I would like to see, in an alternate future, I'd like to see Mitt Romney get elected and then try to get that through the Congress and see the aftermath of that. Realistically, it'd probably be nothing, but our relations are already soured with Iran so badly at this point that it wouldn't have much of an effect. We've already declared their Republican Guard a terrorist organization. But still, these are strong words that I really don't think should be bandied around just kind of at will and whenever you feel like it. You know, people get in a lot of trouble for saying stuff like that, and I would definitely say that something along those lines said in a campaign context could really come back to bite that guy in the ass. All right, that's the campaign. We're going to take a bit of a break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about nukes in the Middle East and the end of the world. So hold on. You are listening to The Machine Church on killradio.org. Back, you were listening to The Machine Church on killradio.org. Before we wrap up the day, we're going to talk about our requisite end of the world topic, and today's end of the world topic is a nuclear Middle East, and that goes across all the boundaries from nuclear power to nuclear weapons and everything in between. The first little bit of information is actually from about a week and a half ago. And this is something that I was planning on reporting on last week. We ran out of time for it. But basically, on September 6th of this year, the Israeli government carried out an airstrike against Syria, which, first of all, Israel will not confirm nor deny their role in carrying out the bombing, even though satellite images have clearly shown that it was Israeli planes flying out of Israel into Syria to blow up something. And the Israeli government's response to, you know, questions about their taking responsibility for it is meh. But the site that was bombed, now everyone's been kind of trying to figure out what the site was being bombed. You know, some images showed it to look very similar to North Korean-style nuclear facilities. You know, and Syria has roundly denounced the rumors that they're pursuing a secret nuclear program. At one point, they called the location that was hit an empty warehouse. They've also called it a unused military facility, which I guess could be the same thing, but regardless, the syntax is definitely different, so it makes you wonder. Because, you know, when you lie and you get caught in a lie, Syria is a pretty, Syria may be a non-issue at this point, but, God knows what can happen when a nation gets moving. There isn't anything, that's going on too seriously in there right now, but, it's funny because all this stuff reminds me of a really, really old, DOS computer game I used to play called Conflict, where you took the role of the Israeli prime minister, and the whole game was three screens. The first screen, you read the papers to find out what happened. The second screen was your diplomatic actions with all the nations that are neighboring you. And the third screen was all your military acts. And the headlines, today's headlines in 2007, near the end of 2007, read like the computer-generated headlines from this game, Conflict, that I used to play in 87. You know, world watches while Israeli strikes Syrian nuclear plant. You know, I mean, that's almost verbatim the kind of thing you would see in this computer game. You know, the whole goal of the computer game, as you playing the role of the Israeli prime minister, was to take over everyone around you and not get crushed. So it's definitely analogous to what's going on today. Nevertheless, Syria got bombed up, and everyone's been shrugging. And on every side, everyone's been shrugging their shoulders to what exactly happened. Now, the U.S. has put down some pretty intense sanctions on Iran. You know, there was the resolution that declared Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist organization, and all of the fun little restrictions that come with that from an international point of view. You know, and the Revolutionary Guard is a main unit of the Iranian defense, and it's kind of like if Canada all of a sudden decided that the Marine Corps was a terrorist group and passed a resolution in their cabinet and in their Congress that was the case. So that's basically what we've done there. And I can imagine how upset Americans would be if Canada did that. So we can only imagine how upset the admittedly volatile Iranians are, given that. We've also put sanctions on three of its largest banks and eight individuals that our government is saying are engaged in missile trade and the backing of extremist groups throughout the Middle East. Now, you know, the quotes that come out are things like, quote, unfortunately, the Iranian government continues to spurn our offer of open negotiations instead of threatening peace and security. That's Condi Rice with that one. And if I remember correctly, at last year's UN General Assembly, the president of Iran requested a private meeting face-to-face with President Bush, which was denied, to the point where the U.S. White House requested time schedules for the movements of the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, to ensure that there would be no risk of Bush and Ahmadinejad even passing each other in the hallway, because they didn't want the issue of them actually meeting and having to talk face to face. God forbid that two leaders who are at odds with each other actually sit down in something like the UN General Assembly and meet up and talk about what's going on between their two countries. So, you know, saying that they're spurning the offer of open negotiations, maybe there's some truth to that in the current diplomatic climate. But in my view, and based on what's happened in the past, there's been some offers of negotiations, and they've been turned down because I'm not going to meet with a terrorist. Nevertheless, you know, there's a report that came through last week, and this was from Mohammed El-Baradei, who is the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and that's the UN's nuclear watchdog who is in control of all the inspectors that are so talked about when things, you know, when nuclear when we go in to look at nuclear issues. You know, he said reports are showing that Iran would need 3 to 8 years to produce a bomb. And that's a pretty big span. And it depends on, I guess it depends on how their moves with Russia go to get authorized to use their Russian know-how to build some nuclear power plants. Obviously, Israel isn't happy about this. Now, the interesting thing about Israel has a policy called nuclear ambiguity, where they will neither confirm nor deny their capability, their nuclear capability, whether they have nuclear weapons or not. Let's see. I've got that, some interesting information on that somewhere. Let's see if I can dig that up. Here it is. All right. Because of Israel's ambiguity, the nuclear installations that it has are not subject to any kind of inspection. So every other nation in the Middle East has any kind of nuclear ambition, there's UN inspectors there trying to figure out what the case is, what's going on, what the technology is. There needs to be transparency. The UN needs to be able to go in there and just find out what they need to see. That isn't the case with Israel. They get to enjoy a policy of ambiguity where no one gets to see what they have or how much they have. Now, here's an interesting little tidbit. Back in the 80s, a former technician at an Israeli power plant, nuclear power plant, by the name of Mordecai Vananu, was arrested and spent 18 years in prison after giving details of the country's atomic program to a British newspaper. Now, the information that he gave out was enough that some outside experts were able to deduce just about what capabilities Israel has. And the conclusion is that Israel has the world's sixth largest stockpile of nuclear weapons. Now, that's a pretty nice place to be in, especially when you consider the fact that they're under a program of nuclear ambiguity where they don't have to say exactly what they have. So a nuclear-armed Iran, probably a pretty big threat. But then again, so is a nuclear-armed Egypt, and we'll get to there in a moment. You know, the whole nuclear issue is something that should have been put to bed after the fall of the Iron Curtain. But it's just as viable now as it ever was. We just weren't paying a whole lot of attention to it because there's been other issues to be dealt with in the last 5 or 6 years. But right now, the new U.S. plan for a missile defense shield is the plan will install a radar base in the Czech Republic and 10 interceptor missiles in Poland. And these are both former Soviet Union satellite states. They're now members of NATO, so they're now allied with the U.S. in that sense. But it's part of a missile defense program that the U.S. has been on, which involves defenses in California and Alaska. And their intent, according to the U.S., the official intent is to defend against long-range missile attacks from countries such as North Korea and Iran. And, you know, those countries really don't have the capability right now. You know, you're talking about Iran needing 3 to 8 years to produce a bomb, period. And that's not counting an intercontinental ballistic missile delivery system. You know, they don't have ICBMs. That technology is a little bit harder to come by. Not if they're in bed with Russia, but that hasn't become complete just yet. As for North Korea, it's hard to say. U.S. nuclear inspectors just went into North Korea today. Hopefully we'll get some more information on that for next week's show, but North Korea's ability, kind of fuzzy. You know, like Israel, they're not saying what they've got or how much of it they've got. But the thing is, the U.S. is doing that, and that's, you know, that it's pretty obvious. California, Alaska, Poland, these are all states that are kind of in the way of any Russian missiles that happen to come through. And Russia is back. Russia is resurging. It's on the rise again. So it doesn't surprise me that the U.S. is trying to do some work to hold them off. And it's also a reason that Russian President Vladimir Putin is so vociferous in denouncing it, because that would put him a step back. You know, the reason we haven't been blown up in a nuclear catastrophe is a concept called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, which is, you know, anybody that saw War Games with the tic-tac-toe computer knows that the whole concept is you can't win. If they launch, we launch, and they launch again, and we launch again, and everybody gets blown up 8 different times, and everybody's dead, so there's no point. Why do it? Because you're just going to kill everybody on the planet. That's why we haven't had it happen yet. You know, and Putin is using terminology like he's calling the U.S.'s plan to put the missile defenses in Eastern Europe the tantamount to the same thing that happened with Cuba and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was as close as we ever came to actually getting blown the hell up. Now, on the concept of getting blown the hell up, we've got some information as of Tuesday. We've got a request in Congress. And according to the news report, the request in Congress is to develop a new bomb designed for a U.S. airstrike on Iran. And this is for production of a weapon with an excellent title. It's called the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, or MOP. This is a 30,000-pound conventional bomb, and the whole point of this thing is to deploy it from a B-2. It's a bomb that can go through up to 65 meters of earth and blow the hell out of things. You know, a U.S. weapons analyst described it as going through the earth like a hot knife through butter. Which, you know, I mean, they're guys and they have big toys. So, I mean, they're going to use fancy euphemisms to describe how effective they are. But here's the problem. We don't need to develop this bomb. We already have it. The money is to manufacture it and develop technology to make the B-2s able to deliver it. And this bomb has one specific reason. This bomb is to drop on Iran. That's the only reason for it, because what we've got now, the ordnance we have now, is more than enough to take care of any ground issue we have. This bomb is being designed specifically to drop on underground facilities in Iran and other places in the Middle East. And, you know, they're not even trying to obscure what the plan on this. You know, the request is to develop this weapon for a U.S. strike on Iran, and that's on the documents that are in Congress being looked at right now. They want $88 million for this, and in the grand scheme of things, $88 million isn't all that. But we're still building massive bombs to drop on a country that we're talking about we don't want to have any military action against. You know, at least that's the current stance, is that we want diplomacy against Iran. But then a report comes out that we're designing a 30,000-pound bomb that can be dropped from a plane that no one can see to blow up things underground. I mean, it's all pretty cloak and dagger in effect, but the talks about making it happen are pretty plain and pretty bald-faced. You know, they're talking about they want to develop this bomb. It already exists. And I know it exists because I know somebody that's seen it. So, you know, we're talking $88 million to build a few of these bombs and make the B-2s able to carry them. It was originally supposed to be carried on a B-52, but you can see that plane. You can't see a B-2. Nor can you see what gets completely destroyed underground when it penetrates the earth up to 65 meters and annihilates an underground installation. And on top of all this, on Monday of this week, Egypt's president announced plans Monday to build several nuclear power plants. And the immediate U.S. response was, good, go for it, awesome. You know, they say Iran's, you know, cheating on their quest to get nuclear power. And Egypt announces plans to build several nuclear power plants, and that's a good thing. as far as the U.S. is concerned, even though Egypt was one of the forerunners in the war that we had, that was that occurred in the Middle East in order to wipe out Israel. That I took less than a week, I believe, to try to conduct the war and for everyone to like strike and fall back. But Israel was a front runner, and if anyone believes that Israel wouldn't or that Egypt wasn't, pardon me, Egypt was the front runner. If anyone believes that Egypt wouldn't use technology they gained against Israel in the case of a regional conflict, you're a fool, because none of the nations around Israel really seem to like that state very much, you know. And we're talking about Jordan, Turkey, and Syria. You know, Lebanon's a little too small and too scattered to have this kind of strategic technology. But all the stable states in that region are looking toward their own nuclear power. And, you know, a nuclear-armed Mideast is a Mideast that is 10 years away from bombing itself into oblivion and possibly including the whole world. So it's the end of the world. Not yet. It's got a ways to go. It's going to take, you know, at least 10 years for these facilities to come online. And even after that, you know, we won't know what the final result will be. But that's where we're at. We've got a nuclear armed Iran, you know, in the wings. We've got Mideast nations that are getting ready to build nuclear power plants on the first step toward possibly developing their own weapons. We've got the U.S. designing massively over the top unnecessary weapons to destroy an enemy that we haven't even started fighting yet. And we've got candidates that can't seem to make up their minds on what they want to do about it. So the next few months will be interesting to see what these primaries bring us and who's going to be fighting it out for taking over Bush's seat if he actually gives it up, if nothing happens, quote unquote, in the meantime, to give him some kind of backdoor from actually leaving office in the wake of a peaceful election. But that's a conspiracy theory that I'll talk about at some other point. That's going to end today's transmission. Hopefully next week we're going to have a guest who spent some time in D.C. on the Hill with the campaigns, with the lobbies and the campaigns. If we can get him in here, then we're going to go more in-depth on the campaigns and what's been going on with them. And that's it for today's transmission. You have been listening to The Machine Church on killradio.org. And we're out. We'll see you all next week, as long as the world is still around.
Covered with